Does God work through children to help others? Do children have a vocation? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February is How Can I Help? God's Calling for Kids. It's a great book for children ages 4 through 8 and only costs $7.99. How Can I Help? Is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can check out How Can I Help? God's Calling for Children at issuesetc.org.
Ad conditionem certam perveni, viris mias, in gravescente etate, non iam aptas esse ad monospitrinum eque administrandum.
Let's stay united. We love Benedict XVI. Jesus is in charge of the church. It's his church, and he's going to guide us through whatever happens.
The question that we need to fundamentally ask when we go to the scriptures is, where is this forgiving my sins? Where are the promises of God? How does this text set me to stand before the face of God?
I like to think of the blind beggar as the first Lutheran. He recognizes that he has nothing, nothing to offer Jesus. All he can do is receive from Jesus.
Injury do players in Iowa, love issues, etc.
Tomorrow is the day. It's the day of love and the day of cards and of candy and flowers. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's good to tell those you love that you love them, even to ask them to be your Valentine. But here's one of those Hallmark holidays that has its roots, a very, very thin root, by the way, the thinnest of roots, perhaps, in the celebration of the church. On the 14th of February, the church remembers Saint Valentine. We should say Martyr Valentine, a man of whom we know very little. Now, his times are a different story. We know a lot about his times. We'll be talking about that as we talk about 3rd century martyr Saint Valentine on this Wednesday afternoon, February the 13th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Thanks for tuning us in. Dr. James Buescher will be our guest for the first few minutes. We'll talk about Valentine. Then we'll discuss the companions of the Apostle Paul, Aquila, Priscilla, Apollos. The church is remembering them today. Dr. Jeff Oswald of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis will be our guest. After that, Terry Mattingly joins us. Of course, the big religion story is the resignation of Pope Benedict XVI. How has the media been covering that story and the stories that spin off from it? Dr. Martin Noland will join us in the last half hour of the program. We're going to talk about a confessional Lutheran perspective on Pope Benedict and on the office of the papacy on this Wednesday afternoon. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-IE. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, and our Twitter address, @issuesetc. Dr. James Buescher is Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Buescher, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Todd.
Before we talk about the little that we do know of this Valentine or a Valentine, we do know when he lived and that he died mm-hmm. under this terrible Emperor Claudius. What was it like for Christians living during this time in Roman history?
Yeah, I mean, the 3rd century here, the 200s, does represent a bit of a change for the church, especially since 250 Decius, when he became emperor, that the persecution is becoming much more intense. It's becoming empire-wide. I mean, if you think about the 2nd century, the 100s, persecution was going on then as well, but was much more kind of sporadic and localized, mainly because the church herself was such a small minority in the 2nd century. You only had really pockets of Christians, and therefore martyrdom was more intimate, more localized, more limited to specific areas. But now in the 3rd century, really ever since 250, we have more of an empire-wide policy against Christians in a more universal way. And I think that's one big change that's taking place. The other thing is that a lot of these emperors, like Claudius, like Decius, the Roman Empire is really in decline at this point. And so these emperors are trying to hearken back to the 2nd century when Rome was at its height, and they're trying to recover that golden age of the 2nd century, emperors like Trajan. In fact, Claudius even had taken the name, when he became emperor, took the name of Trajan. So they're trying to regain that golden age. And part of what that means, maybe most fundamentally what that means, is a return to the civic cults and the pagan religions that are at the heart of every Roman city, and the duty of citizens to now offer sacrifices. It's going to be a requirement. And in fact, there's going to be no way to hide anymore, because the empire has established a way of making sure that every citizen is offered sacrifice. They are issuing what are called a libellus, or a certificate that shows that you've sacrificed. Once you've sacrificed in front of the authorities, they give you the certificate, and then you're safe. So if you don't have one of these certificates, if you're a Christian and have refused to go and offer sacrifices, it's becoming much harder for you to kind of hide under the radar. So it is much more intense time of testing for Christians, especially now that they have grown to a certain status of minority. The Roman Empire is not overlooking them anymore, definitely focusing their attention on Christians, and are trying to compel them to return to being faithful Roman citizens and offering sacrifices to the gods.
Now, this is an important point. I'm glad you start us there, Dr. Buescher, because there is often the misconception that Christians suffered persecution, and that the motivation of the Romans, or whoever they may be, the emperors in particular, was somehow a special animus against Christianity in its theology. But it sounds to me like really the political goal here of the emperor and the empire in general is to try and regain Rome's glory, and Christians kind of get in the way of that.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I mean, if you're thinking of it from the Roman point of view, they're trying to have strong cities. They're trying to return to that golden age, and part of what that means is we have to be in harmony with the spiritual realm and with all of the gods. And in fact, you know, they're convinced, really, that it is our apostasy from the gods, that we are not doing sacrifices, we're not propitiating them, we're not petitioning them, we're not as pious as we ought to be. That's the very reason why the Roman Empire is in decline, and we are receiving kind of disfavor from the gods. So they are very interested in a very positive way about how do we regain the unity of the empire. In fact, you know, Decius, when he demands these sacrifices be made, calls it a sacramentum of imperial unity, right? This is a way to again unify the Roman Empire and to move forward and to appease the gods and be who we are meant to be, you know, in the Roman Empire. So Christians, yeah, there's no special animosity just against Christians in a unique way. It's just the fact that Christians refuse to do their duty as Roman citizens and offer sacrifices to the gods.
So what do we know? You mentioned Decius. You mentioned he's kind of following in the – Claudius is kind of following in the footsteps of that previous emperor. What about Claudius himself? How does he – simply maintain that policy, or does he intensify the policy?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure I can give you kind of maybe definite differences that, you know, but he's really kind of continuing on that same. He's a military commander. Claudius has come to power, and so many of these emperors now in the third century do not last very long. It's one of the changes, part of the decline of the Roman Empire, that the emperors in the second century, I think you had, for the first 80 years, you only had four emperors. Now you're having, in the third century, I don't know, there's hardly any of these emperors that last more than 10 years. So, they're coming and going, and each interested in their own power. And certainly Claudius is trying to do the same kinds of thing as Decius. One of the things that may be a bit unique about him is it seems that he was thought that his soldiers, his army would be stronger if he had single men fighting the wars. And so he kind of outlaws marriage for these young men, wants them to be soldiers. And that may be, in fact, that's one of the things associated with Valentine. It may be one of the things that has brought him into trouble. is that he has continued to perform these marriages of these young men in secret. And so there is some thought that this is one of the things that has brought him into trouble.
Why did Christians, and this would have included Valentine, of course, why did Christians refuse to do their civic duty by Rome?
Yeah, mainly, you know, the fundamental reason is going to be because the civic duty to Rome is to, you know, curse Christ finally and worship these pagan gods and submit to them. You know, the way you have to remember, I think, that in Rome, there's no division between church and state, and there's no kind of notion of secularism. Politics, wars, these are all spiritual affairs. You know, if an earthquake happens, if a volcano happens, if barbarians invade, all of these things are fundamentally spiritual realities. And so they you know, to do your duty to the Roman Empire means that you must do your public duty of you know, participating in the sacrifices, participating in the pagan festivals, the athletic events like the Olympics or something like that that are at the heart of every city. And so you're spending money on meat that's been sacrificed to idols. You're participating in sporting events and plays and theatrical events, all of which have worshiping elements to them, incense being offered and things like that. So it is precisely that very public sin and public idolatry that Christians will find that they just cannot be a part of it, and therefore their confession of Christ will inherently be a very public affair as they refuse to participate in these kinds of things.
We're talking with Dr. James Buescher about the 3rd century martyr, St. Valentine. One day in advance of Valentine's Day, the church's celebration, of course, on this Wednesday afternoon, February the 13th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Martin Luther taught that the chief function of music and worship was the proclamation of the Word of God. With Heirs of the Reformation, Treasures of the Singing Church, you will hear over 2 centuries of Lutheran musical theology, beautifully performed and faithfully sung. For a limited time, save 10% on this 4-CD set when you use promotional code URA. Simply visit cph.org today. Lutheran thought, Lutheran substance, Lutheran music. Brought to you by Concordia Publishing House.
Did you know that Logia, a journal of Lutheran theology, sells CDs and audio downloads of teachings by some of the top Lutheran theologians in the country? Check out Logia's 99-cent download of the month at shoplogia.org, shoplogia.org. You'll also find books published by Luther Academy and, of course, the quarterly Logia Journal at shoplogia.org. Continuing education for the confessional Lutheran, shoplogia.org.
Historic, authentic Christian radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Higher Things assists in cultivating, encouraging, and promoting a distinctively Lutheran identity among their youth and young adults. To fulfill this mission, this summer, Higher Things has 3 conferences. You can find out more about these conferences at fromabove2013.org. The winter issue of Higher Things magazine is now available. This is a topical issue on church and state that you can read in its entirety on our website, higherthings.org.
This is Pastor Clint Poppy, Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Lincoln, Nebraska, a proud supporter of Issues Etc. Each month, we host the Nebraska Lutherans for Confessional Study, a serious study of Lutheran theology. We generally meet on the 4th Thursday of each month from 9:30 to 2:30, and both clergy and laity are invited. There is no charge to attend. For more information, please call the church office or visit our website, goodshepherdlincoln.org, and click on the green NLCS tab.
The Cathedral Choir and Orchestra with Behold the Lamb of God. It's playing right now at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Now, if you listen to Sacred Music for the World at LutheranPublicRadio.org, absolutely free 24/7, you will notice that starting today there is a distinct Lenten emphasis in the music that's playing there at LutheranPublicRadio.org. That's because it's the church's music and it follows the church's year. It's 24/7, it's free, it's LutheranPublicRadio.org, Sacred Music for the World. We're talking about 3rd century martyr St. Valentine. Dr. James Buscher is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Before the break, you were describing the situation of martyrdom that the church found itself in the 2nd and 3rd century. I take it then that at Valentine's time, martyrdom isn't just an occasional thing, but for Christians at that time and where they are, it is commonplace.
Yeah, I do think it's becoming much more commonplace now. Christianity has grown in numbers quite a bit. I think maybe in the 2nd century, Christians probably don't even represent even 1% of the empire's population. But now in the 3rd century, they've grown quite a bit more. Rome is taking definite notice of them. And so I don't think you can hide anymore. You know, the church is very public. They know who you are if you're a bishop. And so bishops, oftentimes pastors, are the first ones that are going to be, are going to be arrested, brought before the tribunal, asked to offer sacrifices as leaders of their community. And so, yeah, it's becoming much more a universal reality. Everywhere in the empire, they are, forcing Christians to make this choice of whether to sacrifice to the gods or not.
Can you explain to me why the penalty, at least at this time in the Roman Empire, for anyone but Christians in particular, refusing to offer sacrifice to the Roman gods publicly? Why was the penalty death?
Yeah, it's a and it probably wouldn't maybe be immediately death. I mean, certainly there were other things that would come along with it. They might begin by taking your land away from you or threatening to take away your land or your estates. That was especially true in North Africa. If you have any assets, they're going to start there. Torture and things like that to try to get you to change, your mind and choose. But ultimately, death is going to be the final kind of punishment of this utter stubbornness of some Christians who just will not give in. And I think, quite frankly, the reason is, and I think this is where maybe the notion of St. Valentine on February 14th is somewhat significant, is that Rome knows the way to get people to make a different choice is to bring about fear. And fear as a motivator, fear and the passions as a way to control people's will. I think this is what Rome is interested in. Death is the ultimate penalty that causes a profound fear in people. And certainly Christians experienced martyrdom precisely that way, as a conflict between fear and love. In this world, we are kind of dominated by the fear of death. And martyrs certainly had to experience that. Jesus himself has to face that in Gethsemane. This fear of death that causes us to turn into ourselves, causes us to isolate ourselves, causes us to seek the preservation of our own existence above everything else. That is certainly what Rome is bringing to bear, is that strong, passionate withdrawal from death, that we want to avoid that at all costs, is a strong motivator. And of course, for martyrs, the way to overcome that, finally, has got to be through love. And this is, I think, where maybe even February 14th and Christians kind of associating the martyr with what love is. Love is maybe has its most prominent image in the martyr, namely that greater love hath no man that he lay down his life, right? Perfect love casts out fear, as John says. And I think this is what the martyrs, the conflict that they are experiencing in their own passions, their love for God, their love for Christ, their love even for their fellow man, for the church, that is what is motivating them to pour out everything, right? Give up everything for the sake of Christ and even endure death itself. And I think that's how they're experiencing even the resurrection. The resurrection now is the freedom to lay down my life for the other. It is the freedom that allows love to now conquer fear. And I think that passionate conflict, that conflict in the passions themselves is profound in these the early martyr culture.
So what do we know about Valentine's death?
Yeah, as you say, we don't know a great deal. There are some stories associated with him, and we're not exactly sure, how truthful they are. Much of that is maybe passed down by oral tradition and doesn't get written down till later. But it seems that what we do know of him is that he is a priest in Rome, martyred in 270, was beheaded, and of course, there are some stories that kind of get associated with him. Maybe the most prominent one that comes down from the Middle Ages is that he had befriended the jailer's daughter, who happened to be blind. It taught her about Christ, and even some reports that through praying with her, she actually had received her sight. And then, of course, you get the notion that when he then is taken to be martyred, to be beheaded, he leaves behind a message for the jailer's daughter that was simply signed from your Valentine. And that, of course, is seen as the source for kind of the common greeting on Valentine's Day. And I think, how much of that is true, we simply do not know. But I think it does maybe capture a bit of the significance of that early Christians put are tied to the martyr as this kind of icon or image of what it meant to truly love one another, to truly love Christ.
We obviously here in America live in a time where there is also pressure. There's not the threat of martyrdom, per se, mm-hmm. or of death, but there is pressure for Christians to simply take their side, take their place alongside the pantheon of American civil religion and to enter that forum there. What can we learn from Valentine and the other martyrs' example to instruct us here in the 21st century?
Yeah, I think certainly, the martyrs, since really the beginning of Christianity, the noble army of martyrs have been examples, have been inspirational examples of what it means to love Christ above all things, right? I mean, kind of it ends up being an image and example of what it means to keep the first commandment, right? That we worship Christ above all gods and before all else. And so that kind of that loyalty that they show, in fact, that's one of the aspects that for early martyrs in this kind of culture, you often get the notion of faith, pistis, probably more than just defined as trust, was defined as loyalty, right? To say in the creed, we believe in one God, the Father Almighty, that notion of believe there, of pistuo in the Greek, carries this notion not just of we trust in him, but we are loyal to him, and a loyalty that will give up everything, right? Go, take up your cross and follow him, follow Christ in the way that he goes. I think, therefore, they remain that kind of example to us, an inspirational example of those who faced the ultimate kind of penalty, the ultimate cost, and, of course, faced that in the faithfulness of Christ and with the power of the Holy Spirit were able to stand there and give testimony and to confess and to witness to Christ, and the ultimate witness being, of course, their belief in the resurrection, right? That you can take, as Luther will say, take they are goods, fame, child, and wife, let these all be gone, they yet have nothing won, right? The kingdom ours remaineth. And I think they are, you know, primarily just inspirational examples of what it means to love Christ and to obey the first commandment.
Dr. James Buescher is Assistant Professor of Historical Theology and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It's always a pleasure, Dr. Buescher. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
When we come back, we're going to spend a little bit more of this Wednesday afternoon talking about some of those ancient saints. These ones from the New Testament, the pages of the book of Acts. Three of them, in fact, remembered on this day, Wednesday, February the 13th. They're companions of St. Paul, well, for a short time, but they are significant contributors to his missionary efforts. They are missionaries in and of themselves. We're talking about Aquila and Priscilla, husband and wife, and of course, Apollos. So we'll go to the book of Acts right around the 18th chapter and remember the companions of St. Paul with Dr. Jeff Oswald of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. When we come back from this break a little bit later, Terry Mattingly will join us. We'll talk about media coverage of Pope Benedict's resignation, and then we'll round off today's issues, etc., getting a confessional Lutheran perspective on Pope Benedict and on the office of the papacy with Dr. Martin Noland. Stay tuned. We're joined now by listener Rocky. Rocky, tell us about the tax benefits of donating stocks to issues, etc.
What we discovered in talking with our tax people and our stock advisors is that it would be beneficial for us to be giving our charitable donations by this means, by giving stocks, which meant that we could give a stock and essentially say if you gave a $100 stock, it's straight money to whatever charitable organization you want to give, as opposed to cashing it out, we'd only be able to give whatever portion was left over after the tax consequences.
How would you advise our listeners if they're interested in donating stocks, bonds, or mutual funds?
They need to go and talk to their stockbroker or their tax person, and I think they'll find out it makes a heck of a lot of economic sense. And you're much better steward with your money, because what you're ending up doing is stretching the dollars that you're able to give donation-wise, and you're able to give a whole lot more directly to those people that you want to support, and you're able to preserve much more for yourself using the laws that have been provided for it.
Rocky, is there anything that we left out that you want to tell our listeners?
Well, the only thing that you've missed is that people really need to support issues, etc. This is a terrific way to do it in a very economical way. It's a way to do it and be good stewards of the resources that God has blessed people with. And I would encourage everyone to support issues, etc., in every possible way that they can. And if this is available to them, I'd encourage them to look into it, because it not only will help them, but it'll help issues, etc. also.
To find out how to reduce your tax burden and support this worldwide outreach by donating stocks, bonds, or mutual funds, talk to your stockbroker or tax advisor, and then call Craig here at Lutheran Public Radio, 618-223-8385.
Where doctrine is life. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Last year, Congressman Mike Pence from Indiana introduced a bill to stop federal tax funding of Planned Parenthood, the nation's largest chain of abortion mills. It passed the House and was defeated in the Senate. In the process, millions of Americans were educated to the deadly agenda of this abortion industry giant. This year, Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee is introducing the bill because Mike Pence was elected governor. During the year, you'll need to contact your congressman and two senators to tell them to stop funding Planned Parenthood with your tax dollars. It's a huge problem with a simple answer when Congress is looking for areas to spend less. When we prevail, it'll save countless babies and spare their mothers from the anguish of abortion.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.